This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being. Neijing is the concept that taking medicines for an illness is like digging a well when thirsty. Neijing Now, placing and taking responsibility for the health of the individual and the planet. From molecular biology to global ecology, from political socioeconomics to psychology and spirituality. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, empowering host resistance. We can be found on the web at neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander, and I welcome you to another edition of Exploring Neijing Now. We are recording our first episode from a cottage just outside Dalhousie, Himachal Pradesh, India, 7,500 feet up in the Himalayas, with a view of the mountain range over which Burma lies. Today we're going to simply define the terms and set the stage. What is well-being and host resistance? We'll discuss what the fields of public health, preventive medicine, and clinical medicine entail, and we'll make a brief assessment of the strengths and weaknesses of allopathic medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, acupuncture and Chinese medicine, homeopathy, and faith healing. Finally, we'll make the distinction between the tradition of healing and the skill of the practitioner. First, this week's headline medical news. June 8th, the FDA approved a vaccine believed to be 100% effective against human papillomavirus, types 16 and 18, which are the strains that cause 70% of cervical cancers in women. It also protects against two other strains, 6 and 11, that cause almost all genital warts. The immunization series costs $120 and is given in 3 injections over the course of 6 months. The vaccine was developed at the University of New Mexico Health Sciences Center and is being marketed by Merck and Company. About half of sexually active adults in the U.S. are infected with human papillomavirus. Cervical cancer causes 3,500 deaths in the U.S. and about 300,000 deaths worldwide. Cervical cancer is the 8th leading cause of cancer death in the U.S., but is second in developing nations. The global incidence may be close to 500,000, with 1/5 of the cases occurring in India, according to the International Network for Cancer Treatment and Research, a non-profit, non-governmental organization in Brussels. On examination of the demographics of who gets cervical cancer and who dies from it, clearly it's a disease that affects poor women more. The incidence in the U.S. has dropped significantly due to the widespread use of the Pap smear to detect cases in the early stage, when treatment is more effective at preventing illness and death. In affluent countries, only about 10% of cervical cancer cases detected are in their late stages, whereas in India, about 75% of cervical cancer cases detected are already in their late stages. Now, primary prevention of infection with human papillomavirus is possible through the use of condoms and barrier methods of contraception. Another method of reducing risk is to reduce the number of sexual partners one has. The vaccine developed will help boost the body's immune system against the virus, but will not eliminate the need for using condoms to prevent infection by other sexually transmitted diseases. And use of the vaccine will not eliminate the need to continue with regular pap smears to detect cancers that are caused by other strains of the human papillomavirus. Despite being mired in controversy created by conservative Christians who believe that immunizing adolescents against human papillomavirus will encourage promiscuity, the Bush administration was unable to prevent the FDA from finally approving the vaccine for use. Now, in areas of the world where the incidence of cervical cancer is very high, and where secondary preventive measures such as pap smears are not widely used, and where women often do not have the social rights and empowerment to demand condom use from their partners, the availability of this new and expensive vaccine will be determined by Merck & Company and international government policies. The World Health Organization, WHO, launched an initiative to address the global shortage of healthcare workers. About 60 countries, half of them in sub-Saharan Africa, have severe shortages of healthcare workers. An estimated 4 million workers are needed to fill the gap, with a goal of 2 to 3 workers per 1,000 people, with priority given to skilled birth attendants and childhood immunizations. Through a model similar to the Education for All Fast Track Initiative, a fast track training initiative for healthcare workers will address its goals through 5 aspects. 1. Mobilizing direct financial aid to healthcare training institutions. 2. An exchange of faculty and students between training institutions in industrialized nations and developing nations. 3. Nurturing academic leaders in developing nations. 4. Developing innovative teaching methods through the use of information and communications technology. And 5. Assisting developing nations in the planning and creation of comprehensive national health workers strategy. Be reminded, in terms of creating and promoting well-being amongst individuals and communities, medical care is only a very small factor. Lifestyle, diet, education, hygiene, social capital, which means things like healthy relationships and community harmony, political stability, safety in the workplace, and happiness have a greater influence on quality of life and health than does access to a healthcare worker. One would never think that having properly functioning brakes might actually be harmful to anyone's health. Maybe not the drivers or passengers, but the folks who work on brakes for a living. The International Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine reports a study done in 3 small automobile brake and clutch reprocessing factories in Japan, which shows there is heavy exposure of asbestos in the process of machine grinding and leveling of new brake lining surfaces. Enclosures and local ventilation are measures that can reduce exposure to asbestos. People who work on brakes and clutches should ensure their employers provide proper personal protective equipment that is approved for work with asbestos and for proper ventilation. For information on what types of masks are approved, visit our website at neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org. The original 1989 Environmental Protection Agency ban on the manufacture, processing, importation, and distribution of asbestos in the USA was actually put aside in 1991. There currently is no EPA ban on the use of asbestos in the United States. There are still many products in which it is used, and it is still being sold and used in developing nations. One single fiber of asbestos can cause mesothelioma, a cancer in the lining of the lung. There is a movement for enforcing a global ban on the use of asbestos, which is being met by strong opposition from the asbestos industry, particularly in Canada. For more information, visit our website at neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org. As reported in the peer-reviewed journal Alternative Therapies, contaminated produce is responsible for the majority of foodborne illnesses. A report by the Center for Science in the Public showed salads, lettuce, sprouts, tomatoes, and melons were the most common carriers of salmonella, noroviruses, and cyclospora. While produce caused the most individual cases, more than double of chicken, seafood caused the most multi-person outbreaks. The most common cause of contaminated produce is contaminated irrigation water and the use of improperly processed manure. Food preparers and cooks can also cause cross-contamination by raw meats and by contamination with human fecal waste due to improper hand washing. May was Healthy Vision Month in the U.S. This year, the focus was on preventing eye injuries at work. About 300,000 work-related eye injuries are treated in U.S. hospitals per year. Information to assist employers, workers, and communities in reducing workplace eye injuries is available at www.healthyvision2010.org. You can find a link to this site at our website, www.neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org. May 31st was World No Tobacco Day, sponsored by the World Health Organization. 10% of premature deaths worldwide are related to tobacco use. The number of deaths due to tobacco is expected to double from 5 million in 2005 to 10 million in 2010. Tobacco is harmful in any form. Light cigarettes, low-tar cigarettes, smokeless cigarettes, cigars, bidis, hookahs, kreteks, clove cigarettes. Tobacco increases the risk of getting many types of cancer, not just lung cancer. It also increases the risk for strokes, heart attacks, and high blood pressure. And cosmetically, it promotes bad breath, yellow teeth, a hoarse voice, and wrinkly skin. This is old news, and the Neijing perspective would be, if you are a smoker, try quitting. If you are not a smoker, don't start. Summer often means swimming. According to statistics from the Center for Disease Control, drowning is a leading cause of accidental death and is the second leading cause for children ages 1 through 14 in the U.S. Fatality rates are the highest for those under 4 years old and for males of all ages, and most of the drownings occur between June and August in the U.S. Other countries may have higher rates in other months depending on when the hot seasons are in those areas. Environmental protections such as fences, warning signs in local languages, and lifeguards can help reduce drownings. Alcohol should not be used when boating or swimming, and widespread knowledge of first aid can also help reduce fatalities. Learning to swim at an early age and being confident around water is another important preventive measure. In this first episode of Neijing Now, I simply want to define the terms and set the stage for future episodes of Neijing Now. So first of all, let's define what is well-being. The World Health Organization definition of health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. Well-being is a state of balance and harmony in which the activities of daily living are fulfilled with ease, and one has the energy and capacity to be creative and productive and to share one's talents with society. Now, host resistance is a term you may not have heard before. Host resistance refers to the body's capacity to resist disease in spite of being exposed to disease-causing agents. We all know people who never get a cold, even if they're constantly exposed to other people with colds. Even though these people may be infected with a cold virus, they do not fall ill with the disease we call a cold. This is the difference between being infected and being ill, the difference between infection and disease. Now, another example would be tuberculosis. Most people who are infected with the tuberculosis-causing bug never develop the disease tuberculosis, and therefore they can't transmit it to anyone else. They're not ill and they're not contagious. They don't get the disease because their body is strong enough to keep the organism in check, and they can happily coexist in harmony with the mycobacterium for the rest of their lives or until their host resistance drops. This concept of host resistance not only applies to infectious agents, but can also be applied to emotional and physical stress or trauma, and perhaps even environmental toxins and genetic disorders and occupational hazards. As we progress through the editions of Neijing Now, we'll discuss the factors determining host resistance. Briefly, they would include, primarily, socioeconomic status, quality and quantity of sleep, quality and quantity of food, mental and emotional fitness, physical fitness, relationships and touch, the capacity for creative work, and even laughter. The science of public health first attempts to determine the factors associated with diseases and then attempts to intervene in a manner that will address many people at the same time through infrastructure development, legal remedies, political action, cultural changes, and social education. The development of sanitation systems or water treatment plants is an example of addressing a health problem from a community perspective. Or inspections of food delivery operations for hygienic conditions is another example. Educating the public about the use of condoms as a method of reducing the risk of transmitting or acquiring sexually transmitted diseases is a public health measure. Because of the way public health is now being funded, often in large part by interest groups and foundations, the activities have become very disease-specific. Public health departments and organizations address one disease at a time, whereas in truth, often if one addresses aspects of the structure of society, politics, economics, or infrastructure, or education, many diseases can be tackled with one intervention. We'll be talking with Dr. Leela Caleb-Verkey, who was a nurse prior to earning a doctorate of science in public health from Johns Hopkins University, with a specialty in maternal and child health. Until 2005, she was working with the Population Council in Delhi. I asked her to speak to us about the field of public health.
I saw a lot of people coming in repeatedly with things that could have been checked or treated or prevented much earlier along the way. It's a field that looks at not just getting ill, but staying healthy. It looks not just at a single person's approach to how to stay healthy, but more than one person, maybe a group, a family, a community, a country, and the world. It has a much, much broader focus, yet on an individual level, it does influence a single person's ability to stay well, prevent illness. It's a very advanced discipline. It's not something that is, an offshoot of medicine, I would say. It's definitely something that has its roots way beyond clinical medicine. It takes into consideration a lot of things that make people healthy or not. To give you an example of women's health in India, many of the problems that women have during childbirth or surrounding reproduction are things that are not really related to that very day of having a child, but are related to her whole life, perhaps of what food she's been eating, that she's been staying healthy, where she fits into the family, if she has the ability within the family to feel that her needs are important and people listen to her, so she can go to seek care where she needs it, so that maybe perhaps on the day that she's actually going into labor and delivering, it would make a big difference if she was healthier to begin with, so she'd have maybe a healthier baby. She wouldn't have deficiencies such as anemia, which is widespread here. And if she has a problem, she'd know where to go and the family'd listen to her.
I suppose her occupation and the economic needs of her family also play a role in how healthy she can be.
Absolutely. I think what occupation one has or where one fits into the family has a lot to do with how society sees women and where they fit in. And I think that most women generally think first of their family and then of themselves as individuals. So more so than men, perhaps women, I think, are an indicator of how important it is to look beyond an individual.
So what is the relationship between public health and clinical medicine?
Public health, I think, is the foundation, the big framework on which decisions at the larger scale are understood by people who work on healthcare. Clinicians work specifically on issues most probably related to when something breaks down or doesn't work or doesn't function. So I think clinicians, in my mind, are basically pathologists. They're looking at things when they go wrong.
What would you say are the strengths and weaknesses of how public health is practiced today?
I think public health is a very political field. It has a lot to do with people's rights and the ability of people to function in a society and their place in society. And most public health institutions of education, higher education, treat it as if it's a neutral subject, or they shy away from the politics of public health, so that most of the practitioners who come out of it have not really been challenged in their political views. I think it would be naive to think there are no hierarchies in public health. There are. Even in that, I think it's the physician who, or the clinician who really gets the top rung jobs. And at least for India, that still holds good, because most schools of public health really are basically subspecialties of people who already have a clinical mind frame, which makes it very difficult to break the mold, you see, because you're dealing with an individual and then suddenly you're being pulled to try and look at things in a sort of community perspective, which narrows its approach. The other thing that, at least for India, I can say, and perhaps for other countries, is that public health somehow, just because the word public comes into it, which really is a misnomer, it doesn't necessarily just mean public, it means community or more than individual. In India, it tends to mean what the government does. There's a whole lot of work that is left completely out of its framework because it's considered something that you only look at government programs, or you look at issues which the government can solve, and very little is conceptualized or thought about in terms of how groups of people, maybe not within the government framework, can get together and do something, so that, you know, we're still at a very early stage of even thinking about regulating or controlling or monitoring or encouraging systems of care beyond what the government does.
One thing I've noticed about the practice of public health is that it has become somewhat disease-specific. A way in which I see public health almost losing its focus by becoming too focused.
I think you can see it from a lot of perspectives. One of which is that from a donor perspective of people who are trying to help to actually see results, it's so much easier to count numbers of cases prevented. And you must have heard of this phrase, you know, fully immunized but dead, you know. Mm-hmm. So you die of malnutrition, but you didn't catch any of the vaccine preventable diseases. There is really concern. That is what's happening for many illnesses, including, say, HIV/AIDS, where, again, the money goes specifically for treatment for trying to, you know, prolong the life of someone who is HIV positive. And yet the environment in which they live or the violence or the disempowerment still continues and more people get it, but that's where the money goes, or the choices that donors make. So in that sense, I think it is very much donor driven. I think when people think of disease prevention, at least for most of India, the sense is that the cultural and the social conditions are very complex. And so they think this is an easier, perhaps, way of going about it. I don't think that it replaces providing clean water, but that comes under a different department. So, however, the roots of behavior change which are required for it are so difficult to change, which are related to purity, impurity, which caste one belongs to, where one lives, or whether water is a communal shared resource, or if it's something that is put through a tap to the house. In urban areas, legal, illegal construction, whether water can be provided to people who are squatters and are using land which is not supposed to be for housing. So there are complex issues there, and sometimes it's easier to have one shot and, you know, prevent a disease rather than deal with the social and political issues behind them. There is a cycle to this. We're sort of perhaps almost over this cycle of individual disease prevention. We're getting back into the sort of long framework of primary healthcare and the sense of health for all. The pendulum will move back to the other side. I mean, I see this happening with a lot of things. I've been in the area of safe motherhood now for 20 years, and I've seen it come into fashion, get out of fashion, and not be considered important or be considered the most important thing, depending on the priorities that countries give and the politics involved in international aid for these things. To me, that's what public health is about, is trying to help people make those choices themselves rather than have it dictated by others. But of course, it is very, very complex how you get to that stage and allow people to do that.
In fact, what we need in the field of public health are more architects and engineers and politicians and sociologists and educators and people with other areas of expertise.
I think it's the architecture of a building having an influence on health may be a bit too tenuous for someone to think they're working on public health. But on the other hand, I think civic development or construction or whatever is absolutely important.
Well, that's what Naging Now hopes to explore, those relationships.
Good luck. It works for you. And I think as you explore other systems of medicine and other alternative solutions to issues related to disease, I think it'll help broaden a lot of people's perspectives on what makes for healthy living.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I'm very pleased that you're using a word that a lot of us don't know, and so we have to ask you about it. Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Preventive medicine is a field of medicine which can be seen from the public health viewpoint or the clinical perspective. Preventive medicine can be considered to occur at various stages in the disease process. So in medical terminology, we call them primary prevention, secondary prevention, and tertiary prevention. Primary prevention takes place when we take care of conditions or circumstances so that the chances of developing a disease are minimized. A public health example would be placing stop signs at dangerous intersections and educating drivers to stop at these in order to minimize the possibility of an accident. A clinical example might be maintaining an ideal body weight to prevent obesity-related diseases. And since May 31st was World No Tobacco Day, I might add, primary prevention would be to never start smoking. Secondary prevention occurs when one detects a disease and takes action to prevent its progression or spread. A public health secondary preventive intervention might be isolating a person with tuberculosis until the risk of contagiousness has been eliminated or minimized. A clinical example of secondary prevention would be taking medicines for diabetes or hypertension regularly to control the disease and prevent the complications caused by uncontrolled diabetes or hypertension. And since May 31st was World No Tobacco Day, secondary prevention might be to stop smoking due to recurrent colds or chronic bronchitis as a measure to prevent more serious illnesses. Pap smears or other tests designed to detect diseases in their early stages are another example of clinical secondary preventive measures. Tertiary prevention is taking an action after a disease has taken hold in order to minimize the effects of the disease. So, having an emergency public warning system and evacuation plan in place in the event of a natural or man-made disaster is an example of a public health tertiary preventive action. Performing surgery for appendicitis or coronary bypass surgery is an example of clinical tertiary preventive medicine. The action is not only a treatment, but prevents death or further illness from the original disease. Most of clinical preventive medicine focuses on secondary and tertiary prevention. Public health ideally should focus on primary prevention. Now, usually when you think of medicine, you think of clinical medicine. Clinical medicine is the art and science of addressing the diseases and problems of an individual in consultation with a health professional. The first and primary interest of clinical medicine is advocating and taking action in the interest of the health and happiness of the patient seeking care. Clinical medicine can be practiced through many traditions of healing, actually. Allopathic medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, traditional Chinese medicine and acupuncture, homeopathy, Unani, shamanism, and even faith healing are the primary traditions patients turn to when in need of treatment. The practitioners of each of these traditions study their art and science for many years. Allopathy has gained popularity because of its use of scientific studies to guide its development and because the therapeutic modalities it employs often require less individual lifestyle changes. There has been an increase in the use of the double-blind randomized controlled study in recent years. So double-blind means that both the researchers and the subjects do not know which treatment is being given to which study participants. Randomized means that the distribution of age, gender, class, race, education, and things like that should be about equal amongst both groups, especially class, because economic status is the overwhelming determinant of disease, and if there are more poor people in one group of the study, then the results could simply be due to their poverty rather than the treatment employed or the risk factor being studied. Controlled means that there is one group in the study receiving the intervention and the other group receiving a placebo or no intervention. The sciences of the other traditions of medicine have not, until recently, employed the peer-reviewed, published, double-blind, randomized, controlled study to guide the development of the tradition. These sciences have developed over thousands of years through careful observation and study of the human body in its environment and the use of elements and plants available in the environment. So let's actually define allopathic medicine. Allopathic medicine is what we generally refer to as Western medicine. Allo is a prefix originating from Greek, indicating difference, variation, or opposition. So allopathy can be defined as a method of treating disease by inducing a condition that is different than the disease or the cause of the disease. In theory, if one were to create a condition that is different than the cause of the disease, the illness itself should resolve. Often what occurs in allopathy is that the condition of the disease is changed, but sometimes the new condition is not necessarily a state of well-being or good health. It may simply be a state that is free from the symptoms of the initial disease. Now, the strengths of allopathy are that this system of treatment often brings fast relief from the symptoms. Allopathy seems to be the best care to seek in acute problems, trauma, and emergency cases. It also uses the language of modern science, which comforts and convinces the public and professionals. Allopathic treatments are explained through the terms of chemistry and molecular biology and physiology, and these foundations are rational. One weakness of allopathy is that the treatments tend to be harsh, and the chemicals and procedures used often produce effects that are unpleasant and sometimes harmful. Another weakness is that the research and development of treatment modalities is funded and guided by the pharmaceutical, biotechnology, and insurance industries. So that means that the progress of the science then is determined by business interests. Take a look at Ayurveda. Ayurvedic medicine is an ancient tradition of healing developed in the subcontinent that is now called India. Ayu is the Sanskrit term meaning life, and Veda is a Sanskrit term meaning science. So Ayurveda is the science of life. It explains the functioning of the body in terms of the qualities found in nature, and examines health in terms of the manner and conditions in which a life is lived. So by qualities, we're referring to characteristics, which would include heavy, light, dark, oily, dry, cold, warm, rough, smooth, quick, slow. These are categorized and reflected in five basic elements in nature: fire, water, earth, air, and space. Now, individuals are born with certain qualities and tendencies, generally with more of the qualities of one or two of the basic elements of nature. The conditions and manner of living have their own qualities, which can either exacerbate or balance the inherent nature of the individual, producing either well-being or disease. So the treatments in Ayurveda are aimed at optimizing well-being through providing foods and herbs and lifestyle changes and even semi-invasive procedures like enemas or emetics that have qualities which will counteract or balance the qualities that have gone out of balance. Ayurveda is also based on the principle that sensory input causes psychological changes, neurological changes, hormonal and immunological changes within the body that can produce balance and harmony or the opposite. So treatment modalities consider the sensory nature of the therapy, including the light or the color or the sound or the touch or the smell of the treatment. A strength of Ayurvedic medicine is that it takes into consideration the way an individual is living and requires modification that aims at correcting the cause of the imbalance. Treatments for imbalances also take into consideration the natural inherent characteristic of the person, and so therapies for similar symptoms might vary from patient to patient. Another strength is that treatments are generally based on substances found in the environment, including plants, oils, and minerals, and not on synthetic compounds. Now, a weakness of Ayurveda is that it often requires willpower and commitment on the part of the individual to sustain dietary and lifestyle changes over a long term. This is difficult for most people, let's face it. Another weakness is that with mass production and distribution of Ayurvedic remedies, in the context of a social and political environment that is not committed to safety, hygiene, and consumer protection, toxic contaminants have been found in a few commercially available products.
I spoke with Dr. Madhusudan Deshpande in a phone interview. He is an Ayurvedic physician who has been practicing Ayurveda for 25 years. He studied at Vikram University in Ujjain and has now been practicing at the Sambhavana Clinic for the Survivors of the Union Carbide Gas Disaster in Bhopal since 1996.
नहीं आयुर्वेद में क्या है तो पूरी हमारी परंपरा का चिकित्सा पद्धति है
Firstly, Ayurveda is our traditional system of medicine. Secondly, it is harmless and it is ideal for our environment.
Can you explain how Ayurveda works in theory?
The five natural elements are manifested in our body in the forms of Vata, Pitta and Kapha. And as long as these are balanced, a person remains healthy and becomes diseased when they are imbalanced. These elements can be balanced with medicines and in severe cases with intensive treatment called Panchkarma.
Ayurvedic treatments focus a lot on lifestyle changes, don't they?
In Ayurveda, we address changes in lifestyle, dietary regimes according to season and the person's inherent nature. Thus, diet plays an important role in Ayurveda. There are some weaknesses in Ayurveda because we have not developed research. Secondly, we believe too much in the ancient texts written about 5,000 years ago. The last edition was also around 700 years ago. After that, no Ayurvedic physician has dared to advance it. A lot of principles are outdated and need to be changed. Needless to say that a lot of things we know need to be linked with modern sciences to develop Ayurveda further.
A lot of people are concerned about possible contamination of Ayurvedic remedies with heavy metals. Can you speak to that?
Nothing to worry, actually. The well-known companies are quite reliable and safe. It is not really necessary that we use heavy metals in treatment. Herbs are effective enough.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Ayurveda and traditional Chinese medicine share a lot of concepts, and it's thought that perhaps traditional Chinese medicine, TCM, has its roots in Ayurveda. It's known that many scholars of ancient China came to India to study and to take back their knowledge to China. Undoubtedly, there would have been an exchange of ideas and concepts. Well, the Chinese took the concept of marma points and nadis found in Ayurveda and developed acupressure and acupuncture. The points and channels are basically identical in both systems. Stimulation of these points and channels has an effect on the nervous system that produces changes in the psychological, neurological, hormonal, immunological, and circulatory systems. Acupuncture in traditional Chinese medicine is also based on five-element theory. The five-element theory has some similarities with the five elements in Ayurveda, but in traditional Chinese medicine, they are fire, water, air, wood, and metal, whereas in Ayurveda, they are fire, water, air, earth, and space. Traditional Chinese medicine also uses herbs and elements found in the natural environment. TCM and acupuncture, like Ayurveda, attempts to induce balance within the body and harmony in the environment to optimize the body's innate capacity to heal itself. One disadvantage of TCM acupuncture is that many people are afraid of needles. The needles are very slim, and so they don't cause much pain, but still many people simply cannot be assured. The needles are also not hollow bore needles, so they don't carry any blood within them. And in these times, all the needles used are single-use needles, so there's no worry for transmission of disease. The Chinese herbs tend to be stronger than the Ayurvedic herbs and produce faster results. Again, the language and tradition is based on thousands of years of experience and doesn't have the current standard of the double-blind, randomized, controlled study to explain its theories and practices. I spoke with Dr. Rashmi Jha. She is an Ayurvedic physician who is also a survivor of the Union Carbide gas disaster in Bhopal. She became inspired to study acupuncture herself when that was the only modality that offered her relief from the symptoms she was suffering from the gas exposure. She traveled to Beijing and studied Chinese language for 1 year prior to studying acupuncture in Canton. She currently practices Ayurveda and acupuncture in Bhopal.
How does acupuncture work?
Its theory is near like Indian philosophy.
The theory is nearly like Ayurveda, where we study the three qualities of human body, Vata, Pitta and Kapha. The Chinese similarly believe there are two types of energies in the body, yin and yang. The negative energy is yin and the positive energy is yang. Yin yang should be balanced in a healthy person. Any sort of imbalance results in diseases.
Do you think that acupuncture came from Ayurveda?
A long time ago, Buddhist monks had traveled from India to China with the ancient books. Among them was Atharva Veda, in which there is a description of Ayurveda. The Chinese say that though we inherited it from India, we took it further and developed our own system.
I've heard that the acupuncture points are the same as the marma points in Ayurveda. Is that true?
The points defined in acupuncture are the same vital points as defined in Ayurveda. There are a lot of similarities. As we believe in the five-element theory in Ayurveda, acupuncture also believes in a five-element theory. Our organs are composed of these five elements, as is all of the nature. These organs are what get diseased. They are also affected by emotions. The very nature of a person decides his treatment. The acupuncturist, on the basis of a person's personality, his yin-yang balance, and according to the Chinese five-element theory, diagnoses the problems.
तय करता है कि उसको कौन सी प्रॉब्लम है.
Are there any reasons why someone might not choose acupuncture as a treatment modality?
उससे ज्यादा नहीं होता है.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
Let's turn to homeopathy. Homeo is a prefix from Greek, again, meaning alike. So homeopathy can be defined as a method of treating illness by inducing a condition similar to the cause of the disease. The concept is a lot like vaccinating someone in order to boost the body's innate capacity to protect itself or heal itself from a disease. A homeopath gives a patient elements or agents in very minute quantities in order to induce the body to heal itself. Sometimes this causes an initial exacerbation of the symptoms, then followed by relief. Dr. Pradhuman K. Sharma has a PhD in biophysics and retired as professor of electronics and instrumentation and director of the Department of Telecommunications from Punjab University in Chandigarh. He also graduated with a degree in homeopathy and has been practicing for the past 40 years. I spoke to him over the phone just days before his youngest son's wedding.
What is the central theory of homeopathy? This is a very difficult question to answer. The reason is that modern theories of science cannot prove it. It works at such a minute level and instruments cannot read it until the cure starts, and then it looks like a miracle. For it works on the principle of similarities. The action of the drug and the disease, when it comes to the body, they are producing the same thing.
So my understanding, basically the reason somebody is having symptoms when they are ill is because their body is trying to fight that illness.
Exactly.
And so when you give a remedy that boosts those same symptoms, you're boosting the body's own immune or defense mechanisms to fight that disease.
Exactly. So it is a natural cure in that sense. You know, it cures, it does not suppress the disease. Because the cure is coming with fighting with the bodies and antibodies from inside. If you ask me what are the strengths of homeopathy, every single dose works like an intravenous injection. The reason is that its minute molecules get absorbed on the tongue itself and into the bloodstream. It does not have to go to the stomach first and take that 1 hour to start its action. Sometimes the disease gets aggravated like in skin diseases, but the patient overall feels better and then gets cured. Thirdly, it has normally no side effects. Homeopathy is one of the system for a poor person because the medicine is very cheap and every person can eat it. There is nothing like that it is difficult to take. There is no need of injections. It is very simple for the children, for the infants.
Oh, would you say there are any weaknesses?
Yes, there are some weaknesses also. In modern fast world, patients do not want to wait. They forget that a disease which one has for the last, say, 2 to 3 years will take at least 2 to 3 months to cure. They want that the disease may be suppressed, but we want to go on work tomorrow. That sometimes is not possible in homeopathy, especially in chronic diseases. For acute, yes, it can cure also very fast. Secondly, for those who eat strong smelling foods whose taste remains for a long time in the mouth, e.g. garlic, etc., cannot get benefit from homeopathy. Since the remedy either cannot enter the pores in the mouth because they are already blocked, it is also because with those medicines, when you give the remedy which is also in molecular form, they can react and get neutralized. It has failed in America. The America is a coffee drinking nation, and coffee is antidote to most of the homeopathic remedies. Those people who take very less medicine, they get most miracles from homeopathy.
Less medicine meaning less of allopathic medicine.
Allopathic medicines are strong things and coffees and I mean those who are having simple food habits, their natural cure is very fast. So homeopathy is living only because of its merits when people get cured. There are all the forces which say homeopathy is no medicine system. as I have studied Ayurveda also, that homeopathy is basically a part of Ayurveda. They also make, for example, Mukta Pishti. It is said in the books that you have to grind it or triturate it for 21 days. As you want to make it powder, those pearls, they will be done in 2-3 hours. That's right. Why for 21 days? The reason is to increase its potency. So that is the same thing which we do in homeopathy. Actually, if you ask me, all medicine systems should come together and make a final word system which will help everybody, because there are certain things which others cannot do in every system.
That's great. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're so busy with your son's wedding and
Bapare. It's fine.
So let's talk about faith healing and faith and healing. So faith healing might be otherwise termed spontaneous healing. There are many modalities that might come under the rubric of faith healing. One avenue is when the patient has or develops a great faith, and this positivity from within themselves balances their own system to such an extent their innate defense mechanisms kick in and heal their disease or distress. Another avenue is when others pray for a patient. A third avenue might be when a patient seeks care from a spiritually advanced person whose energetics or vibrations or positivity has the power or wattage to be transmitted or shared with the patient in such a way that the healing process begins or the disease process stops. An important aspect of any healing is that the patient must have faith in the method and the practitioner. This faith may be a crucial element of healing. Till now, science doesn't really understand how prayer and faith work, and the results of studies on whether it works at all have been mixed. We won't delve into the evidence for or against faith healing in today's program. I mention it simply to include it in one of the major treatment modalities employed by people worldwide. At a later date, we'll examine the evidence and rationality of faith healing. Mr. Maqbool Caleb retired from 35 years of service, first as a teacher and a pastor, and then as a bishop, first from the Punjab diocese and then from the Delhi diocese. I spoke to him at his home in Dalhousie about his views on faith and healing. What has your experience been with faith and healing?
Faith, I could speak with great amount of experience. You see, within the Christian faith, there are parts in the New Testament which talks about the gifts that God gives to various people. Some have given the gift of prophecy, some have given the gift of being a good speakers, people who relate kindly, who are loving people. But there are also some people who have the gift of what you call healing. And this is healing comes through their relationship with Christ, and the power of healing comes to them. Those people who have the gift of healing, they pray for the person who's sick, and with God's grace, they are healed.
Is there a relationship between the faith a patient has and their own healing?
Yes, that's why he allows the healer to pray for him or place his hands on him, because he also believes that it's the power of God which will heal him, and that also sort of has to be one of the factors. The person who comes and places his hands and prays for him, the miracle just takes place and it does heal.
Is faith essential to healing?
For the healer, yes, indeed. Without that, he couldn't do it, no. Faith does not mean a good life and a luxurious life and a very comfortable life, no. You can go through all kinds of situations of being very sick, very worried, very very burdened with the world's kind of worries and things like that. But you remain faithful that I'm passing through a lot of suffering and sickness and worry and burdens of the world, and your faith helps you to come through all that. Surprising thing that even doctors who are not Christians, they say, yes, this is the medicine, this is your problem, you have a muscular problem, I have one, I have a neuropathy, I feel sort of tired, but they also say that this is the medicine, but also try yoga. And, of course, it's an exercise, but yoga can, the deeper yoga is also a relationship with God, with the Spirit, God, and that also heals. Sometimes you cannot guarantee that faith will just heal you. No, sometimes it's God's will that you just go through this trial of suffering or being not well or having this weakness in the body or in the mind or something. If you have the faith, then you say, well, if it's your will, I will be well. If it's not will, give me the faith that I may go through this time of trial and get well. Or if it's not, I'll just carry on believing in you and having faith in you.
Thank you so much for your prayers.
Bhagwant Singh and his wife Tarlochana Kaur give us their views on faith and healing. He's a practicing homeopath in Dalhousie with over 30 years of experience.
The Almighty does everything. I don't do anything.
Medicine doesn't work. It only God works.
When God is kind,
even
a small thing can work. Even drinking water can be effective.
So you're saying that it is not the medicine, it is...
It is the magic of God.
I have seen people who believe in God. They rarely fall ill. And even if they fall sick, they become better with very little medicine. Regardless of whatever treatment they take.
It is a miracle. मैंने तो हमारे पास एक सुखमुनी
इन वन ऑफ आवर सीक्रेट टेक्स्ट इट इज रिटन
करते हैं वो कहते हैं अनक उपावी रोग ना जाए रोग मिटे हरव खदलाए उपाव का मतलब है
यू मे कीप ऑन ट्राइंग
नहीं जाएगा रोग
जब परमात्मा ने कृपा बट इट इज ओनली व्हेन यू हैव गॉड्स ग्रेस
हम तो उस पर
चलते यू कैन गेट वेल
वैद्य महेंद्र सिंह एंड हिज वाइफ अवतार कौर गिव अस देयर व्यूज ऑन फेथ एंड हीलिंग Vaid Mahinder Singh studied Ayurveda from his father and practiced in Dalhousie for over 60 years.
Everything depends on faith. You have to have faith because if you do not have faith, no medicine will work.
If I have TB and I take medicines for tuberculosis, the tuberculosis will get killed even if I have faith or don't have faith, right?
The main duty of a patient is to have faith. If the patient has faith on the doctor and his capability, he will be cured. But if he doesn't, he won't. Mind is the biggest factor. People might refer a patient to any doctor, but it is only when he feels it is right that he will go to that person. If not, then he will go to some other doctor.
Vaid Mahinder Singh.
You become an experienced doctor only when you go and work in a hospital for 3-4 years. You can get a degree just by studying books. But to become a doctor, you have to practice in a hospital. Spend 4-5 years, get experienced. Actually, it is knowledge that matters. The more patients a doctor sees, the more experienced he becomes. I had a trainee who learned with me for 15-20 years. When he started working independently, people would tell him that he did not look like a doctor. He looked like a kid. As you grow older, then people will have more faith on you. Now I have been working for 60 years. And gathered as much experience. How can a person who worked for 8 years have that much experience? You learn only by working.
I'd like to offer just one note of caution. All the healing traditions have their advantages and disadvantages, and each is better suited to some ailments more than others, and some patients more than others, and even some practitioners more than others. But most importantly, the power to heal is equally determined by the practitioner of the tradition as by the method itself. Surgery in the hands of a poor surgeon is no better than acupuncture in the hands of someone who's never studied acupuncture. Each of the traditions requires years of training. Any tradition in the hands of an unskilled practitioner is potentially dangerous, and every tradition has its risks and its power to relieve suffering. Our concluding poem. The doctor, the docent, the teacher, minister, artist, physician, the mystic, the intuit, the healer, the friend. Nain Aging Now was written, edited, recorded, and produced by Dr. Jayashree Chandar. Editing assistance and translation, Alok Mahendru. Sound engineering advice, Budhaditya Chattopadhyay, Geeta Pandye, Alok Mahendru. Website setup and design, Srinivas Pakanati and Dirk Polson. Tabla and Manjira played by Jayashree. Bass guitar by Pedro Ordonez. Drum set by G.C. Garcia. Compositions from Pandit Swapan Chaudhary. Concluding poem written by Jayashree. Distributed by Gypsy Jays Productions, found at gypsyjays.net, gypsyjays.net. You can find us on the web at neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org.
Very good.